en Daisy Kaplan vormen op het eerste gehoor een klassiek garage rock duo, maar al snel blijkt dat ze toch behoorlijk van de norm afwijken. Kate speelt geen gitaar of bas, maar cello en haar stem wordt naast de band nog ingezet voor opera. De drummer houdt het wel vrij klassiek en samen resulteert dat in een beetje magie. The Swamp Keeper verscheen vorige week en dit staat erop: The Magician van Lung.
No, I won't be cut, burning flowers on your grave. Yeah, I suffer.
Dit was het viertal Genser uit Chicago. Kent u ze nog? Na Just Look at That Sky, hun plaat in het coronajaar 2020, viel de band even stil. Maar nu, na de vervanging van groepslid, zijn ze terug met Animal Hospital. Het is te zeggen, de plaat komt pas eind augustus uit, maar een eerste nummer konden we toch al laten horen. Dit Black Sand van Genser. Wat er in het water van Ohio zit, willen we eigenlijk niet weten. Na het niet zo klassieke garage rock duo Lung daarnet, is het nu tijd voor de bizarre synthpunk van Dana. Hun album Clean Living verscheen deze week en deze paranoïde, scheve One Weird Trick kun je daarop vinden, Dana.
Yeah.
alle weirdness van Dana was het tijd voor rechtdoor rammen. Dit was Chemicals van Split System uit Melbourne. Het staat op een split single die ze zo pas uitbracht. En de andere kant van het plaatje is een nummer van Les Lully uit het Franse Montpellier. Beide tracks werden trouwens gemasterd door Mikey Young. Onze reis voor deze week zit er bijna op. Nog twee nummers te gaan en voor het volgende nummer trekken we naar de Noord-Duitse havenstad Kiel. Daar experimenteert het trio Combinat Robotron met krautrock, psychedelica en noise rock. Op 25 juli verschijnt de Ankh, hun zevende plaat in 7 jaar. Het is de eerste die ze uitbrengen bij Fuzz Club, de perfecte thuishaven voor hun muziek. Dit is Combinat Robotron met Sauerstoff.
Sauerstoff van Combinat Robotron. We gaan eruit met Magnolia, een van de vele jonge, ambitieuze Britse bands. We draaiden eerder al een paar van hun aanstekelijke singles en sinds kort hebben ze een eerste EP uit, Omaha, met een belangrijke rol voor de toeter. We draaien de finale van de EP, het semi-titelnummer Omaha Beach. Check ook de video, want die is zeer de moeite waard. Dit is nog Omaha Beach van Magnolia. Veel plezier met Sterrenplaten zometeen en tot volgende week.
Thank you. Omaha Beach, the last bomb squadron, Gold Leader 3.
Hey friends, how you getting on? I hope you're doing okay, because it is a crazy time to be alive. But it's also a wonderful time. I'm in the middle of a well-needed mental health break. I thought a month-long break would be enough for me, but no. I'm going to need a full three-month break here to get my head back in the game. The truth is, I'm just not able to deliver you the quality programming that you're used to, with my head being somewhere else. So I'm taking some time for myself after going almost nonstop on this podcast for 5 years, making 120 hours of content for you to enjoy. That's what, like 10 novels worth of stuff? Anyway, let me tell you, this break has been transformational, but I've got more work to do, and I'm far from done. I know a lot of you are really itching for something new from me, and I think that's very flattering to see how much you miss me, but I don't have anything ready for you yet. However, there's a podcast I listen to sometimes called Spycast, and I always find it super fascinating. I mean, the show interviews spies, and it's wild. So I wanted to share with you an episode that I handpicked that I thought you might like. My plan is to reemerge in April with some new Darknet Diaries episodes. But in the meantime, give this episode of Spycast a shot and look after yourself. Take it away, Andrew.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, historian curator here at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Spycast's sole purpose is to educate our listeners about the past, present, and future of intelligence and espionage. Every week, through engaging conversations, we explore some aspect of a vast ecosystem that looms beneath the surface of everyday life. We talk to spies, operators, mole hunters, defectors, analysts and authors to explore the stories and secrets, tradecraft and technology of the secret world. We are Spycast. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. This week's episode features one of the most renowned CIA operations officers of his generation, Enrique Rick Prado. To say he's had quite the journey would be quite the understatement. He was born in Cuba, fled the Castro Revolution as a young boy, ended up in an orphanage in Colorado. Later, he joined the elite United States Air Force Pararescue Unit. He was a paramilitary officer living among counter-revolutionaries in the 1980s. He went to the farm to become a case officer and had 6 overseas posts in his 24-year career. He describes his only bad habit as liking fast things on wheels. In this week's episode, we talk about his time as CIA counter-terrorist chief of operations, which included September 11th, 2001, his career battling communist insurgents and Islamic terrorists on multiple continents, his experience living among the Contras during the Nicaraguan Revolution, and his time as Deputy Chief of Station and co-founding member of the Bin Laden Task Force. Enjoy. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, it is my pleasure. As you can imagine, for an intel officer to do his first podcast in something like this, you know, the Spy Museum Spycast, That's a heck of an honor for me, so thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's so much of your story that I want to dig into, and I really enjoyed reading your book. That's me read it twice now. I love the fact that you were really into the movie Tombstone when you were in Shangri-La. You mention it in the book, and I was thinking, like, my favourite quote that I can remember is the one where Wyatt Earp slaps the guy and then said, "Are you going to do something, boy, or just stand there and bleed?"
that is a fabulous movie. And for me, Val Kilmer stole the show because he did such an incredible job as Doc Holliday. So my favorite line is the old, "Hey, Johnny Ringo, you look like somebody just stepped on your grave."
Okay, well, let's dig into your remarkable career. You mention in the book that when you were in Langley at headquarters, you never walked over the seal because you had such reverence for it. And I think that that's a good place to start. Take us back in time to the day that you first walked through those doors and saw that seal and saw the memorial wall and what it felt like for you to be joining the storied Central Intelligence Agency.
You could imagine being a immigrant into this country, I've always felt that I had a huge debt of honor to pay back for everything that it did for me. It was surreal for me. I mean, even though I had interviewed, I had taken the polygraphs, I had done all those things, But the first time I walked through that door to get my badge and to go in, I was literally floating across the floor. I never stepped on that seal, not because it's any sacrilege, but it meant so much to me that I would always go around it. I just couldn't quite do it. While Bill Donovan was one of my heroes growing up, Teddy Roosevelt, Wyatt Earp, and him, I've read a lot of their books, and that was a big influence for me, the whole OSS portion, being military and that. It was just one of the highlights of my life, walking through there, knowing that I was going to be part of something, that I was joining something very special. I had no idea that I was going to have such a great ride.
Talk us through that initial period, because you start off as a paramilitary officer, right? And then after a period of time, you go to the farm and you become a case officer. So I found that part of your journey really interesting, because you were, in the book, you discuss how for a paramilitary officer, to a certain extent, you're like a blunt instrument. You've got to be a hard charger and you've got to just go at the problem head on. But as a case officer, there's layers of nuance and finesse in it. And it's interesting to me that transition that you had to make. So walk us through those first few years as a paramilitary officer.
I was an Air Force pararescue. I went in pararescue in 71. And in 74, when I couldn't get to Vietnam because that's what I wanted to do, I wrote the agency, and they sent me back a very nice note saying, thank you, but we're firing, not hiring. Those were very bad years for the agency. Subsequently, around late 79, early 80, I got the bug again, and I wrote again. And at the time, I was writing with Miami-Dade Metro Fire Department as a paramedic, because pararescue, of course, are all EMT2s. They called me back. The agency called me back and said, look, we're not hiring staff right now, but we do have some contract work that you can do as a paramilitary medic when we're doing some training or maybe even missions. And I'm going like, put me in, coach. That experience exposed me to what Special Activities Division Ground Branch was called back then, which is one of the three branches in the in the paramilitary side of the agency. And then when the Contra program, when the Sandinista revolution started getting fought against, you know, we Ronald Reagan came in, one of the first things he did was, is I want a covert action program on this. Well, suddenly I get a phone call in Miami that from the agency said, hey, listen, we have something for you. And at the time, I was tired of the 30-day here and no hope of getting hired. So I asked him a question. I said, just one question. I don't know. I don't care where I'm going or whatever. Is this long-term or is this contract? And when they said long-term, that was it. I said I would do it. So it was really backdooring it into the agency through that. And the reasons they called me was because at the time, the agency capabilities were anorexic. I mean, there have been so many firings and stuff like that after Vietnam. And they did not feel they had a native Spanish-speaking paramilitary officer that could pull off not being an American. So that's why I cut my teeth, was for a little over 3 years. I slept in a jungle hammock Monday through Friday, going to the different camps. And it was arguably the best job I ever had for a myriad of reasons, but primarily it was personal. It was very personal to me, that mission. That was the start. I did 3.5 years there and had some great operations and a couple of good scares and live to tell about them, I guess.
I mean, I think that initial period, one of the things that I find quite interesting, and we can broaden this out a bit, but you said there that it's personal. So I found it quite interesting that you came to America as a result of a Marxist insurgency and guerrilla movement, and then you found yourself in Central America in the 80s. And for you, this was personal. There was a personal connection to it, and not just because of language, but because of your experience as a young boy.
You know, absolutely, Andrew. I honestly believe that each one of us is given a God-given path. And if you have the courage to step into it, it is your path. And, you will endure and you will succeed. I think that from very early age, because of what I saw of the revolution, the atrocities, the persecutions, what they did to my family, I had a very strong conviction about fighting communism. Fast forward to, you know, a couple of years later, now I was able to come to the United States without my parents, came out through a program called Peter Pan. The Peter Pan program was bringing in kids that his parents could not get out. So lucky me, I ended up in a orphanage in Pueblo, Colorado. Quite an adventure. But by the time I got to Nicaragua, it was not only my background and my experience, it was the people I was dealing with. Every night, I would grab a cup of coffee, and I would go sit with a different group of freedom fighters. None of them had red Marx, none of them had red Lenin, but each one had a personal story. They raped my daughter. They beat up my priest and closed my church. They forcibly conscripted my 15-year-old son. And the litany goes on. There wasn't a single person that said to me, well, you know, we have to fight the tentacles of this octopus that is communism. There were really simple people fighting for a real simple thing, which is freedom. And I want to highlight that one of the biggest influences on me was my father, because imagine taking your only child and putting him on an airplane to a country that you've never been, you do not speak the language, and you may never see him again, not for economic reasons, on the quite the contrary, but for freedom. He did not want his son to grow under that kind of regime.
I mean, on the personal note there as well, it's really interesting to me, during your career, you could almost map it onto the war against communism and then the war against terrorism. So you're fighting against this ideology, but it's quite interesting to me because even in your own family, in the book you outline how your godmother's husband was a Marxist, he tipped your family off that you were going to, Rick Prado, CIA legend, was going to be sent off to the Soviet Union to become a promising prospect for the other side. So even within your family, and then your cousin as well, he comes and lets your family know that the guerrillas are going to be coming through your village and stuff. So there's this kind of interesting dynamic going on.
I think that was the theme with just about everybody in Cuba. I mean, we all had, we hope that family blood is a little thicker than anything else, than ideology. In the case of my uncle, I'm married to my mother-in-law, I mean, my godmother, he wasn't a Marxist hardcore, but he was a communist. That was his ideology. But he understood. I mean, I lived in their house for almost 2 years because I used to go to school away from my town. I lived in a very small town. And the school that I attended there, he was one of the professors there. So it was a private school. So I lived with them for 2 years. So I was like his youngest son. And that's the reason I think that he came over. The cousin story was my dad's cousin, and he was one of the rebel leaders in the Escambray Mountains, which is where Che Guevara actually dominated. And he came to the house one night, middle of the night, and told my father, said, look, you know, we're going to take the town, but neither you nor your wife can leave. Because it was my first lesson in counterintelligence. He said, if they see you and your wife leave with your kid, they'll know something is up because they know you and I are related. And so that started the first adventure, which is leaving that town under the conditions and coming back. It was quite a growth period for an 8-year-old.
All of these places where you found yourself, especially in Central America and South America, it's like there's these authoritarian regimes or dictatorships, and then there's a communist insurgency, and then there's a counter movement. So even the term Contras comes from counter revolution, right? And in Cuba as well, the Escambray Mountains, there's also a resistance movement against Castro and that regime there. It's quite interesting to me how you're located within this these big historical forces that you found yourself a part of?
I believe that that was my path. That was my destiny. And you know, you can't use the sword unless you forged it first and have the right steel. And I think looking back now, all these lessons, I would tell you, getting on an airplane by yourself when you're 10 years old, going to an orphanage in Pueblo, Colorado, which is a pretty rough town, and it was a pretty rough orphanage, that was quite a test of my survivability, you know. But, you know, I was, again, blessed with a dad that always brought me up as the little man, your responsibilities. I wish I was as stoic as he was. And again, just the same thing with running the North Korean programs, you know. It was all, I kept gravitating back to these things. And in many cases, they were offered.
So let's go back to your early years and the working for the agency. So you're in Nicaragua. One of the parts of the story that I found quite interesting was there's one part in the book where you realize that you're being set up by a small group of Contras to be whacked, but you manage to set yourself up in a situation that obviously doesn't happen. So can you just tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, I understand as well that you're the only agency officer who's in the camps for 14 months. I mean, so tell us about that experience.
It was, again, I never woke up one morning, Andrew, and said, I got to go to work. Never. Not in my whole career. It was always, I got to go to work. I really found a purpose there. That incident that you're speaking is, there was an incident at the camp where the commander had been compromised, and two of his sub guys became rogue, and they were stealing cattle and all this other kind of stuff. And I was sent there to bring it back. And pretty long process, as you read. There are two guys that I was able to bring back alive, but bring them back under some kind of duress. When I got there and grabbed the first guy and sent him back with one of the local captains, I stayed in the camp. And I was not a case officer yet. I had never recruited anybody. But several months before, this young, very young guy comes to me from one of the camps and says, my wife is ill. I need some medicine. Can you help me out? I reached into my pocket, gave him about $20 worth of Lempiras, and he went off and got the medicine for his wife. Well, fast forward 3, 4, 5 months, whatever it is, I'm walking with another Nika that was in the helicopter with me, and literally it's almost comical because he was behind the bushes, and you hear this, psst, psst, mi mayor, major, major. And so I said, what's up? He goes, they're going to kill you tonight. They're planning to kill you tonight. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah. You know, they know that you're here to get Krill and Caramalo, and they're going to kill you. Normally, when we stayed in the camps, we stayed in the middle because that's how we were more protected. Well, this time they said, oh, this is where you're going to be staying. It was at the outskirts of the thing. And I said, okay. So as soon as it got dark, we crawled out the windows, walked up. There was a substantial hill in front of it. And there's no way I was going to try to get back to civilization. I mean, you know, you're talking 3 weeks worth of walking. But I said, well, you know, at least here we have a fighting chance. We set up a perimeter. We took out a time. And sure as hell, around 10, 11 o'clock at night when it was pitch black, they were there with flashlights. And you could see, you could hear them, you know, you could hear them arguing. Where are they? And all this kind of stuff. Of course, they finally got off. They did not chase us. I had been training most of these guys myself, so they knew that they would be in a fight if they came after me and my guys. Walked back into the camp the next morning, just like nothing had happened. And it was funny because some of the people were like, he's still here. And the other ones were smirking, he's still here. And eventually I got the second guy that second day. So
I just want to discuss the Contras. You call them my beloved Contras. It seems to me that what you're saying in the book, and that example of the two deputies to Suicida as an example, is that the Contras were a group that were made up of many different types of people that had many different grievances and that were fighting the Sandinistas for many different reasons. And if you have enough people like that, you're going to get people that are doing stuff that's not acceptable. That seems to me what you're saying. You're not saying that every one of them is an angel, but you're not saying that every one of them is like a killer. You're saying that they were all organically in this fight for something that was personal, that related to their life, and the fact that they all got painted in the same way for a small percentage of people is unfair to the memory of what they were fighting for. Tell me if I've got any of that wrong.
You're 100% right. The Sandinistas revolution started with some of the former Somoza military guys. They're the first that had to leave because, you know, they were being killed. Same thing that happened in Cuba. You know, the persecutions were theirs. There was no trials. These guys were being summarily executed. So you had the original were people that were lieutenants and captains, and even some like Enrique Bermudez, who was later assassinated by the Sandinistas. They were former Somoza officers. But to say that the organization was Somocista, as many people threw that name out, is ridiculous. You're talking 80% at least of the forces, and even more so the fighting. They were all peasants. They were all simple, you know, Nicaraguans fighting for the causes that I mentioned before. I had a special love with the Miskito Indians. It didn't dawn on me at first, but, you know, for me to be in Honduras and in Nicaragua, that wasn't a culture shock for me because I am Hispanic and I know the culture with its nuances, but nonetheless, but going to the Miskito where they don't even speak Spanish. And there's three tribes there. You got the Miskito, Sumo, and Rama. And that's led by a guy named Stedman Faggett. I just talked to him a couple of days ago. We remain friends. I love those guys because there was even more purity because there wasn't a single Somocista or former Somocista around. And I want to highlight that these two guys that went rogue, that was the exception, not the rule, and that was an anomaly. And the side of the coin that I want to focus on is the fact that we did something about it. We did not let it go. As soon as we found out that this was going on, we took corrective action. So when I say we, we're talking about the FDN, the Hondurans, and of course the Americans behind it.
That experience with the Miskito Indians is a really interesting one. It almost seems to me like they don't need to go through the training. They're like born special forces. They just come off the shelf like that.
They really are because they're people that live off the land. They're all incredible hunters. They're all incredible trackers. Some of them are incredible divers. You read that I used some of their divers to do some serious damage to the Sandinistas. I'm very proud of that one, too. These people were instinctively very adept at patrolling, and they had a lot of support in the area, too. It was a very difficult area. One of the reasons the Sandinistas has always tried to move into the Miskito, the natives area, is because there's some gold mines out there that are very lucrative. So that's always been part of the impetus of them controlling that area, and they couldn't do that with you know, the thousands of guys we were training and arming and sending in. So I had my good experiences with them, and I had one bad experience. I think you read when there was a rift in the Misurasata, and several commanders, I think it was like eight of them, came out. They were going to Stedman Faggett on trial because they were convinced that they were that he was stealing from them, because we had to stop some of the refueling or the resupply because of political things that were going up and down. And I flew into Puerto Limpira, into Rus. Rus was the camp, directly on a helicopter when I found out this was going on. And Stedman Faggett came in shortly thereafter, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And I told him. And then he looks at me and goes, "What are you doing here?" Knowing that, I go, "I'm not going to leave you here." So that night I called a meeting with the commanders, and they all come out. And it was something out of the good, the bad, and the ugly. All these guys had the bandoliers with the stuff, and you know, and they were not happy. I was there by myself. I had a Browning 9mm. What do you do with a Browning 9mm against 600 guys, right? But I had credibility with them because I ate their food. I slept in their, you know, hammocks. I was the guy coordinating the resupplies for them. I had credibility with them. And so I was able to parlay that into a treaty that said, look, if you want to get rid of Stedman democratically, okay. But if you harm one hair on his head, we're going to get you. I mean, we got shot at several times because Sandinistas were all over there. But that one was one of those that, you know, one thing is combat where your blood gets up and your adrenaline kicks in. But when you're walking into something like this and you have to keep your cool and you know that the consequences are going to be severe if you screw it up, it was quite a challenge.
Is that something that you were born with, or is that something that you learned to do when you were in the Air Force doing the PJ? To what extent is it born and to what extent is it created?
Well, I think like in everything that we have, you have, you know, your DNA wiring and you got your acculturation. Like I said, my father brought me up to be a young man. I learned to shoot when I was a little kid. I would, you know, help him drive the cars. I would sit on his lap and drive the cars. I had a horse before I had a bicycle because it was a small town. And so all that, those experiences, yeah, the wiring was there and the mentoring from my dad were there. But then the trip to the orphanage, and then definitely when I got into pararescue, as being one of our special operations forces, the training is very, very intense. The washout rate is no less and no more than SEALs or Green Berets. And making it through SEER school, making it through mountain climbing school, there's a certain level of conquering your emotions that you have to do in order to do all that. But I think that the most important thing was that I believed in what I was doing. I honestly never doubted that I was wearing the white cowboy hat.
One of the other things that I wanted to ask before we move on to your transition to become a case officer was, you speak about how in the Mosquito Indian camps, they weren't penetrated by the Sandinistas because they were such a tight kin group and community. But some of the other ones were penetrated. And one of the questions that I had was, did you have to be cognizant of foreign intelligence officers being around this game as well? Like, was that ever something that was on your radar, like Soviets or Eastern Europeans? Or
we knew that the Cubans primarily were the surrogates for Soviet Union at the time, and we knew that they were coaching the Sandinistas, and they were in many cases leading them, some of their pilots and stuff like that. In any insurgency, I mean, just go back to the OSS days, how many elements of the resistance were compromised because they turned somebody or they recruit somebody or they force somebody into that. You're talking people that it's hard to imagine immorality that you don't understand. If somebody comes up and puts a gun to your daughter's head and says, you know, you're going to help us with this, like they do in these places, what choice do they really have? So it was overall, like, I think believing in what I did was probably the single most important thing, because that cleared my conscience and that steeled my spine.
Let's talk about your transition to become an ops officer. Some of the other people that you were going through it with were straight out of college. And you say that trying to get good recruits that way is almost like trying to choose